Great pleasure to have with me Mark Rubinstein, author of Net Interest. Mark, I look forward to speaking with you about your most recent article. You talk about the fact that in the great financial crisis, we all learned about Hyman Minsky because he had some theories that were actually quite useful in understanding what happened, how the crisis came about. And you'd say that today there is an economist I hadn't heard of prior to reading about him from you is Ronald Coase. So let's learn about him a little bit more.
Well, that's right, John. Typically, there is a economist who may have, at some stage in the past, written some thing and created a framework for understanding certain features of the economy that, at the time they're alive, can appear quite abstract, but subsequently they become very important in the way the world actually works in practice. Two examples are Hyman Minsky, who was, I wouldn't say ignored, but he was certainly underrated in his lifetime. And as you flagged up just in your introduction, did some extensive work around financial crises and became prominent at the time of the great financial crisis, 2007, 2008. People still refer to the Minsky moment in 2007 when subprime started to collapse. Ronald Coase, I think, is the economist of the current era. He died in 2013. He was less underrated in his lifetime. He did win a Nobel Prize, but actually, he didn't really come to the attention of mainstream economic thinkers until 30 years after his very first, or his one of his most influential essays, which was written in 1937. And that essay was called The Nature of the Firm. And Ronald Coase was very interested in the idea that firms exist at all, that corporate entities exist. He questioned that if the markets are so efficient, why do corporations need to exist when individuals at a very extreme level could contract through the marketplace with one another? That was an extreme perspective. I guess the broader, more general question might be, what determines the size of corporations going from the individual all the way through to huge multinational corporations that employ hundreds and thousands of people? What determines their size? And what determines the perimeters of their structure, i.e., at what point do they decide we should do this internally or go out and contract with the broader marketplace? So those are the questions he posed in 1937. And he went on to develop many other elements of economics subsequent to that. And as I say, he did win the Nobel Prize, partly for The Nature of the Firm and also for some other work about social cost. But it's relevant today because we're in an environment where new companies are being formed at a very high rate that are able to contract with some of the large companies. And within financial services, what that means is that many of the big, we can drill down into some of the specific features of big financial companies in a short while. But what's increasingly happening is that many of these big financial companies are finding ways to outsource and to contract with smaller firms that are springing up elsewhere in the marketplace. And all of this was modeled by Ronald Coase.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And you actually also highlight this with a specific example, which is Marqeta, which filed for an IPO this past week.
Exactly. Now, actually, the one thing I didn't mention was Coase's punchline. Coase's punchline is transaction costs. So his answer to the simple question, why do firms exist and what determines the size of a firm, is transaction costs. That marketplace, there are certain transaction costs associated with marketplace-oriented contracts, and frequently internally within the confines of an organization, they go away. And transaction costs are very broadly defined. So they can be the literal cost of transacting, kind of captured in a bid offer spread, for example. They can be the search costs. They can be any kind of friction. They can be the idea that it's very difficult to determine all of the elements of a contract, all of the edge cases, all of the corner cases. And so, for example, ownership of a supplier or an employment contract might override some of the need to determine all of those edge cases. Or in other cases too, it's very difficult ex ante, before the fact, to establish how the economics of a particular contract might be worked out. And therefore, with complete ownership, that doesn't have to be done. And that's another transaction cost, if you like, that's saved. So transaction cost is his punchline. Now, to come back to the question, we have a IPO, which was filed this week, Marqeta. Marqeta is a company in the financial technology space. It was founded in 2010, and its business model is to issue payment cards on behalf of clients. It's a platform that allows clients, its biggest client is Square, but it has several other clients as well, to issue their own payment cards. What is particularly interesting about Marqeta is that it's really actually, I mentioned it's got some other clients, they are a lot smaller than Square. Square accounts for 3/4 of its net revenue. So here we have a company that's going public. 3/4 of its net revenue comes from a single client, Square. And the question I raise is, why did Square bother dealing with Marqeta in the first place? Couldn't it have issued payment cards itself? And the answer comes back to Coase. There's a transaction cost associated. It was frankly cheaper in their case to outsource it to Marqeta. And that's evidenced in the fact that Marqeta, like many startups, has incurred significant losses over the past several years, indeed since 2010 when it was founded. So contracting out to a smaller firm, in this case Marqeta, a lot cheaper than Square developing the R&D and issuing payment cards internally by itself.
And then what's interesting in this particular case is that on the back end, Marqeta has even greater concentration with one key supplier who settles the payment volume. And so the question, I guess, was why doesn't Square just go directly to that supplier?
Exactly, exactly. And I think the same answer applies. It's quite interesting. The people, so one of the features of Amazon that is well known is the strategy to turn cost centers into revenue pools. And this is kind of a roundabout way of, if Square was to have conducted this activity internally, it would have been a cost center. They haven't turned it. Someone else has turned it into a revenue pool financed by venture capitalists. Rather than Square shareholders, to the benefit of Square shareholders, ultimately, because now they're getting this pass-through directly, as you say, through to the end supplier of Marqeta, which is Sutton Bank. Sutton Bank processes 94% of the payment volume. So Marqeta, it'll come to the market, it'll come with a big valuation, but at least today, clearly, it's got a strategy to diversify its client base, but at least today, really, it's a conduit between Square and Sutton Bank.
So let's talk a bit more about the high transaction costs that have been around, I guess, in the financial services sector and other parts of the economy, and kind of expand on that punchline by Ronald Coase.
Well, one of the key features of the financial industry, which I look at extensively, a question, if you like, is why, when most other industries across the economy are no longer vertically integrated, why is financial services and banking and insurance, but banking principally, why is it still so vertically integrated? Why, when you go down the high street, will you see stores, bank branches that sell products that have been designed by that same entity. And as a customer, are you serviced by that same entity? Now, it's different across different products. I wrote last week about the mortgage industry in the US, which isn't vertically integrated. There are mortgage originators, which work at the distribution end of the value chain, and they are different from the services of the mortgages, those that design the mortgages, and those that manage the risk of the mortgages. So that's not consistent across products, but broadly, and certainly in Europe, where there's a culture of the universal bank, there's a very, very vertically integrated industry. And that's not like other industries. Now, other industries did used to be like that. So there are some very famous cases. Carnegie, for example, in his steel business in the United States, going back to the 19th century, owned coke ovens. He manufactured his own coke to create the fuel for his steel mills. Actually, famously, in the 1880s, he realized that it was a very specific event happened in the 1880s, and come back to your prompt about transaction costs, the equilibrium, if you like, shifted such that it was no longer cheaper for him to make his own coke than it was to buy it in the market. And as a result, he sold the coke ovens and shifted permanently to buying the coke in the market. Another great example is Ford. Henry Ford built an enormous factory, which employed 100,000 people near Detroit. And in that factory, he did manage his own coke, manufacture his own coke, but he took literal iron ore and rubber all the way through into completed automobiles. Now, clearly today, that doesn't happen. Parts are bought in. And the reason for that is, again, because transaction costs reduced. In this case, they were the transaction costs associated with search. So the various parts became more standardized. And as a result, Ford and other car manufacturers was able to buy them in rather than manufacture them themselves. So vertically integrated businesses ceased to be vertically integrated, not so in banking. There's a very interesting paper written in the 1980s by some economists who also went on to win the Nobel Prize, who were influenced heavily by Ronald Coase. And they argued that, and they actually used insurance as their example. They looked at the insurance industry. There were two models of distribution in the insurance industry at the time. It's still the case today, maybe less so. Now companies like Geico are going direct to consumer. But certainly back then, there were two models in insurance. Insurance companies could employ an agent, a network of agents, or they had their own internal sales force. And they looked at the differences between them. And the fundamental difference between them was the ownership of the customer base. And their argument was, and it's an interesting paper, it's worth reading, but their argument was that for products where the sales effort is more important, and there's a kind of skew in terms of incentives between the two models, even if the commission structure is similar, there's still a skew in terms of incentives, because if the product is longer term and therefore persistence matters, then there has to be more long-term trust between the salesman, woman, and the insurance company. And where persistence matters, that can sometimes break down. And the conclusion was, for shorter term products, like in the case they used was car insurance, auto insurance, for shorter term products, an agent network makes more sense. But for longer term products, a fully owned internal distribution engine makes more sense. Their example is life insurance. It applies equally to deposits, which are a very persistent long-term product. And actually, if we go broader and go back to the auto industry and other industries, fast-moving industries, where the sales effort is very high and there's no persistence in the product, there's no continued liability from the manufacturer to the consumer, then the sales, the agent-oriented sales structure makes a lot more sense, and vertical integration from a distribution perspective makes less sense. So that's the way things are today in financial services. And there's some argument as to why that will persist for products which are slightly long-term, like deposits.
And then you also mention another reason why banks have been loath to shrink is that historically they've derived the benefit from their size.
Exactly. So there's another reason. Exactly right. So there's another reason as well. So the reason we've just discussed is very kind of is a theoretical reason. There is a empirical reason as well, which is at least before the financial crisis, banks did become too big to fail. And so there was an incentive to grow and not contract out to the marketplace, but to accumulate size through employee count, through and then specifically through assets accumulated on the balance sheet. There have been some estimates as to what that subsidy, if you like, was worth to the banks, but it was very profitable. And the bigger banks, and actually one can almost mark the beginning of the financial crisis by the announced merger between what was known then as RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, and ABN AMRO in the Netherlands. And there was a culture prior to that of accumulating size, the reason being that there was a benefit, direct benefit, from being too big to fail through lower funding costs, which couldn't be outsourced to the market in the way COES had anticipated.
And now we come to kind of all this innovation in fintech, which ultimately lowers transaction costs. So you actually point out, or drawing on a paper by Michael Munger, that a key value proposition is no longer selling products, but actually selling reductions in transaction costs.
It's a fascinating book. So Michael Munger's written a book. He's written a number of papers. He's a professor at Duke. He's written a number of papers and a book called Tomorrow 3.0, Transaction Costs in the Sharing Economy. So his argument is that he talks about three, it's a pretty steep argument. He talks about three eras of economic development globally. And he says we're currently in the third one, where selling products isn't the key value proposition, but selling reductions in transaction costs is. And for him, the corollary is growth in the sharing economy. So he looks extensively at Uber in his book, Airbnb as well, both examples of the sharing economy, where in both cases, transaction costs have been reduced, the cost of search, all the kind of friction costs associated through search and through trust as well, have been reduced. And that has paved the way for the sharing economy. But it's true broadly as well. So in financial services, Marqeta's just one example of many of companies whose purpose is to act as infrastructure layers within financial services to facilitate the break up of that vertically integrated model. So these companies are inserting themselves, they're providing all sorts of services, be it like Marqeta, the card issuing services that allow either existing financial companies or increasingly non-financial companies to offer financial services, and hence break down this vertically integrated model.
And then, of course, regulation has to come in at some point, and there are regulatory implications here as well.
Yeah, and Ronald Coase was very, very focused on regulation. In fact, if we think about his framework of the marketplace and firms contracting with each other, one regulatory response to the corporate entity has been to regulate it rather than its activity. So banks are regulated as institutions. There are various capital requirements that are imposed on them as institutions. And a complaint that they are increasingly having, and the mouthpiece is Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan, who has complained very publicly about playing field no longer being level. that a non-bank doing some banking activities can get some regulatory advantage over the bank, because it's the bank as an institution which is being regulated, not the activity which can be offered either by a bank or by a non-bank. And so as that vertically integrated structure breaks up, then this is going to pose a challenge to regulators. And it's something that they're onto. We've talked in the past, and I've written in the past about a lot of the regulatory implications of what's going on right now via technology in banking. A piece I wrote a few months ago called Policy Triangle kind of tackles some of these issues, but these are all very, very relevant issues in a highly regulated industry such as this.
And as you say, Mark, the boundaries of the firm are in flux, especially today. And Ronald Coase provides a map to understanding that territory.
That's right. That is right, John. Absolutely right.
Well, thank you so much for the conversation, Mark, as always.
Thank you, John. Thank you.